Presiding officer, my time as First Minister is now over.
It is my honour to accept the office of First Minister.
Hello and welcome to The Station, the Scottish politics podcast from DC Thompson that helps you be better briefed. I'm Derek Healy, the Sunday Post politics and investigations editor, and today I'm joined by two fantastic guests. We have politics reporter Justin Bowie, who will be no stranger to our regular listeners, and joining us today for the first time is public affairs expert Kayleigh Quinn. Kayleigh is Associate Director with Cavendish Consulting and was an organiser for both Scottish and UK Labour. Now, it's been a big week in Scottish politics. We have a new SNP leader and a new First Minister in John Swinney. He was chosen by the party after running unopposed and now faces a task of uniting an SNP that seems to have been at war with itself during pretty much the entirety of Humza Yousaf's time as leader. Now, we had a little bit of both Humza Yousaf and John Swinney at the start of the podcast, but I thought we could just have a little listen back, first of all, to what they had to say this week.
Presiding officer, my time as First Minister is now over. However, I am absolutely certain that for the rest of my life, every Thursday at 1 minute to 12 in the afternoon, that my palms will begin to sweat and that knot in my stomach will tighten. That comes, presiding officer, from a place of a deep respect for this Parliament and to all of those in opposition, and indeed to my own colleagues here alongside me. That respect will always continue to be there. I hope we can all live up to the hopes of the founding fathers and mothers of devolution and work together in the interest of the common good, the interest of the common weal, and do so with kindness. Thank you, presiding officer. It has been an honour and a privilege.
When I stood down as Deputy First Minister in March last year, I believed that would be the last senior office I would hold in politics. Having served then as a senior minister for 16 years, I felt I had, to coin a phrase, done my bit. To find myself accepting office as First Minister of Scotland today is therefore, to utter a classic understatement, something of a surprise. It is, however, an extraordinary privilege, and it is my honour to accept the office of First Minister, committing myself to do the best I can for Scotland.
Something of a surprise, eh? Justin, I thought I would start with you. You are covering a lot of the big developments for us this week. Talk us through what the mood was like when John Swinney was voted in as a new First Minister at Holyrood.
I think, to be honest, for a lot of people within the SNP, there was perhaps a sense of relief, almost. I mean, Humza Yousaf had only been in the job for a year. He still had plenty of support within the party. He was, I would argue, by the wider party, also still quite well-liked in a lot of senses. But certainly following his resignation, there was a sense that it wasn't necessarily the man they needed at the top. He wasn't necessarily cut out for the job. He ran into a lot of difficulties in his time in charge. And John Swinney, we kept on hearing this phrase, a safe pair of hands, a sort of steady pair of hands at the till, so to speak. And I think as a result of that, there's a sense that in what was a moment of crisis for the SNP at the end of the Bute House Agreement, they've almost managed to turn it around a little bit. They've been quite efficient with this contest, or a lack of a leadership contest, because John Swinney didn't face a challenger in the end. And there's now a feeling perhaps that they can just get on with it. You know, they can just get on with governing the country again. John Swinney is going to run into a lot of problems, no doubt. That honeymoon period, I think, is going to be very, very brief, if there is a honeymoon period at all. But the other week we were talking about, will there be an election? Can the SNP still govern at all? Is there going to be that terminal decline in the polling numbers? Is that going to get worse and worse? Whereas now they have someone in who might not be well liked by the opposition, but certainly respected. He's seen as a senior, serious figure. And yeah, I think the SNP, given where they were less than 2 weeks ago, are relatively happy at the moment. But like I say, that happiness might not necessarily be lasting long.
I'm always interested in what leaders are like behind closed doors. And one of the things you hear time and again with Humza Yousaf is people say he is genuinely a really nice guy. Like, that's across the board in politics, people tend to say that to you about Humza Yousaf. Has he been too nice a guy here, Justin? You know, was there kind of weak politics from him in a sense? Is that what's kind of done for him in the end?
I think it's difficult, because when you look at what brought him down at the end of the Bute House Agreement, I would argue in some senses it was a pretty brutal and swift move from him. He was saying on the Tuesday that he was still, you know, he was still defending the Bute House Agreement, and by Wednesday night, by Thursday morning, the Greens were gone. And they were obviously extremely upset about that. They didn't take it personally, they said, in the sense that they were making a political move afterwards, but there were certainly a lot of hurt feelings there. A lot of the problems that arose within the SNP, it's difficult, isn't it? Because if he had been more decisive and more swift in his actions, you know, when you think, for example, the suspension of Fergus Ewing or the expulsion of Angus McNeil, which took a bit of time after his initial, you know, kind of suspension as well. If he'd been more swift and just booted them out of the party, he would have been getting talked about as someone who just wasn't listening to the other side, who just, you know, was silencing his critics. But then the problem is, if he listens too much to his critics, he perhaps gets seen as weak and perhaps gets seen as not being decisive. So I think it's a difficult one. I mean, you're correct. I think Humza Yousaf is seen generally as a pretty nice man. You know, certainly the media, people found him quite good to deal with a lot of the time. He, you know, didn't shy away from questions and from taking questions either. So it's a difficult one, because I would argue when you get to what actually brought him down, it wasn't niceness and weakness. He just quite simply didn't really have the parliamentary arithmetic there to not listen to the Conservative wing of his party, but also not listen to the Greens. So it was quite a difficult situation he found himself in.
Kayleigh, we heard from Humza Yousaf, we heard from John Swinney there. I'm interested to get your take. What did you make of what we heard this week?
You're right to say people across politics recognise that Humza Yousaf is a nice guy. I think what we saw yesterday in terms of at the end of the debate with John Swinney going to shake hands with the opposition leaders, that what he might try to do is make capital of this grace period where he's seen as a decent guy as well, but that's simply not enough. As we've seen with Humza, you have to back it up with good policy and good governance. So that's what he needs to concentrate on, not just being this stable, safe pair of hands.
And did you get a sense from the things we heard from him that that is the direction John Swinney's going to take? He is going to try and reach out to other parties and be more open to working with them now?
I think that's right. I think he has experience, obviously, of working with the Greens. And while he'll want to set himself apart from the last couple of years in politics and kind of hit the reset button for the Scottish National Party ahead of the general election, he has to look beyond the Green Party. I think if you think about the numbers in Parliament, if I was Alex Cole-Hamilton right now, I would be starting to think about making some serious demands of government, not just the SNP, but also looking at the polls just now, it's pretty much neck and neck between Labour and SNP, depends on which poll you read. Labour are only slightly ahead. If they get into government, they're going to need partnership as well. So it's time for the Lib Dems to step up and maybe make some more serious policy cases and the sort of things that they would want a government partner to do for them.
It's really interesting. I don't know if that's something that's been kind of hugely picked up yet by others in the media. But yeah, I mean, it puts other parties in a really strong position if they can go to the SNP and say, you know, we can do this, we can do that, and work with you on these kind of areas. Kayleigh, we touched a little bit on your kind of background and working with Scottish Labour and UK Labour as an organiser. So you'll be used to trying to, you know, pull a party together when it's maybe in tougher times, struggling a little bit. Do you get the sense that John Swinney is the man to pull it all together for the SNP? Has he been kind of making the right kind of suggestions along those kind of lines?
I do. I certainly have experience of working for a party in turmoil. What I envy about the SNP is that they managed to get things over and done with quite quickly, although they have packed a lot of drama into the last 12 to 13 months, whereas Scottish Labour dragged it out over a wee bit of a longer period. But for me, as a staffer, I think going into an election campaign, it's really, really tough if you work for a party that's going through the sort of big changes and dramatic moments that the SNP is going through just now. So the first thing probably that him and Murrayfoot have to think about in terms of getting themselves on an election footing is making sure their foot soldiers are ready for that, supporting their staff, making sure that everyone in head office feels supported, because that can really trickle down through the party. You know, if the people who you expect to deliver your plan on the ground don't feel like they know what's going on, they don't know what's coming next, then that can really destabilise your campaign. If you don't have the morale in head office, you don't really have it on the ground either. I think that he is a compassionate guy, and that will speak volumes to the people within the party that need to go out and deliver results for them in the general election.
I thought it was quite interesting to watch during, so I should explain a little bit first of all. So when a new First Minister is selected, so you have the party will choose the leader they want, and then you have this sort of weird situation where you then go to the Scottish Parliament and MSPs vote for the First Minister they want. It's almost pretty much guaranteed that that person chosen by the biggest party is going to be First Minister. But you do have a situation where you have sort of Douglas Ross getting votes from the Tories, despite the fact there's, you know, there's no way he's going to be First Minister really in that way. It was interesting to look on and watch the faces of some of the Green MSPs who looked absolutely thunderous when all this was going on. I think it's fair to say they felt very, very slighted. I mean, there were stories about when it was announced to Cabinet that the Greens, the Blue House Agreement was going to come to an end, the Greens were leaving the government, of their ministerial colleagues, SNP ministers, cheering and hitting the desk with fists in celebration that the Greens were going to be leaving. Justin, is there any way back, do you think, in terms of working closely between the SNP and Greens? We're not going to have, I don't imagine, any repeat of the Bute House Agreement, but are they going to be able to work together after all this, or is it going to be very, very frosty?
It will be frosty, but I think they're going to have to work together purely because of the parliamentary arithmetic. The SNP don't have a majority. They are going to have to depend on the Greens to some degree. I mean, this is why the Bute House Agreement came about in the first place. The SNP and Greens had worked together before when the SNP were in minority government, and they could just rely on the Greens on a sort of policy-by-policy basis. They might not always back them, but there was a kind of understanding there. The problem is now that Parliament is very polarised in a wider sense, that the Tories back in the day used to, for example, back SNP budgets if they could get some key demands in them. I just don't really see that happening now. The Tories take a much more stringent kind of stance of opposition, in the sense that for years perhaps trying to be constructive didn't really work. The SNP made gains. I mean, that first Parliament, they could perhaps rely on the Tories to help them pass budgets, and they then went and got a majority afterwards because they were seen as a party that could do deals, that could work across Parliament, and that helped them. The problem now is, you know, the independence question is so big and our politics is so polarised that the Tories don't want to be seen to work with the SNP at all because their voters don't like that. Labour don't really want to work with the SNP too much as there is a sort of, you know, both parties agree on plenty in terms of policy and, you know, economics and social issues when you get down to it. You know, Anas Sarwar wants to be First Minister in future, and he wants to make life difficult for the SNP. The Lib Dems are, of course, there, and, you know, absolutely, as Kayleigh said, could make some of their own demands, but as a unionist party, obviously don't want to be seen as too cosy with the SNP either. So apart from your one alibi MSP, that really leaves the Greens. But the problem is you have that difficult situation where the more conservative wing of the SNP, or, you know, whether you call them that, or they're just slightly different in terms of how they view policy, isn't going to be happy with John Swinney working with the Greens either. So it's a really, really difficult thread for him to needle here. But I think the idea that's been floated by some, you know, by Alba and by the Conservatives, that John Swinney can just ignore the Greens, it just isn't going to work. In some way or another, he's going to need them to pass policy. So it's going to be difficult. What might benefit him is that the Greens, I think, played their hand by helping to bring down Hamza Youssef. They showed their anger, they showed their frustration, but I don't think they want to be seen to bring down an SNP government fully. That's not necessarily in their interests. So you do wonder, have they now played their big hand? And if they get one or two concessions, will they go back to being a bit more conciliatory? Because they don't want to perhaps be seen as a party that just endlessly brings down SNP governments. So, yeah, it'll be a difficult one for John Swinney, but perhaps ways for the parties to still work together.
I spoke to a few people within the SNP just the weekend there, trying to get a sense of where the mood was as it was becoming clear that John Swinney was sort of chosen one. He was the one coming in. A lot of them spoke of the chance to move away from what they described as the sort of culture war kind of policies that we've seen from the SNP over the past 18 months. They're obviously referring there to things like the Gender Recognition Reform Bill. They were also, I think, very optimistic. I think they spoke of a feeling of unity that there's not felt that there's been like in quite a long time as well. Justin, one of the problems with not having a leadership contest is we don't really know what John Swinney does stand for yet. That's something that's still to kind of be fleshed out over the days and weeks and months ahead. Do you get the feeling, Justin, that John Swinney is going to look to abandon some of those kind of things and move in a slightly different direction?
I think it's possible in some senses. I mean, John Swinney is obviously a very experienced government minister. He was there from the first days of SNP government through all of the Sturgeon years. So he's not, I mean, he regards himself as somebody on the centre-left of the SNP. That is how he's framed himself. But I'm sure you could argue maybe some of the younger MSPs and some of the younger SNP figures are perhaps slightly more progressive than he is in certain respects, although he is backed a lot of that progressive policy that the SNP has put forward. But I do wonder on something like GRR, for example, the SNP obviously supported that, wanted to pass it through Parliament. But obviously that was blocked by Westminster. There has been a lot of talk around, you know, legal challenges. Hamza Youssef backed that. I wonder if that is something that John Swinney might quietly park, not because of his, you know, views on GRR. He obviously voted in favour of it and obviously wanted that to pass. But I wonder if the idea of another court battle and what could end up being another defeat for the Scottish Government might just be something that he wants to avoid. We obviously had similar a couple of years ago with, you know, the independence question going to the Supreme Court. And I think at the time the SNP hoped that that defeat in the Supreme Court would, you know, boost support for independence and would create a lot of anger. But in the end, I'm not really sure that it did. It just, in some senses, it was, you know, the SNP lost that fight. And when you're in politics, you don't want to be seen as losing these key fights regularly. And at a time when people are really worried about the economy, cost of living, you know, I do wonder if some of the rows we've seen over these subjects, GRR obviously was one, the deposit return scheme was another. There was a lot of blaming back and forth between Holyrood and Westminster. Another policy the Greens were obviously instrumental to being involved in Holyrood as well. And that's obviously been kind of ditched for now. It appears the Scottish Government's much more likely to follow the UK's path on that. It's just, I wonder if whether you think Holyrood or Westminster are responsible for some of these debacles, even if you're the SNP and you blame Westminster. There's just not really any benefit to having these fights. People aren't getting angry about Westminster stepping in here. And perhaps for John Swinney, it's going to be more about finding those key economic measures which can boost the SNP polling support again. And while the unionist parties might not want to work with him, it's perhaps about putting forward measures which make it difficult for them not to. You know, for example, I mean, he talked the other day about the Scottish child payment. Child poverty is something that he's pretty keen on eradicating and tackling. So if he can propose good measures for that, for example, it's going to be much harder for opposition politicians to say, well, no, we don't support those measures, because clearly all of Holyrood main parties, you know, support tackling child poverty. So I wonder if there might be more focus on the economic side of things, given John Swinney is Scotland's longest serving finance minister as well. It's a brief that he knows well, and perhaps less focused on some of the more divisive topics, whether for right or wrong.
It's interesting, because that is the thing that when I was speaking to people came up time and time again: cost of living, growing the economy, dealing with poverty. That seems to be what SNP figures have an appetite to now go on and try and tackle in a bigger way than maybe they were before. I think it's quite interesting because, you know, with the Greens, some people I spoke to suggested that maybe this was quite naive in a sense, because what the Greens have basically done is, so there are problems, okay? So you have the climate targets being missed, you have the gender recognition stuff getting put onto the kind of back burner, you have the cash review into gender services coming out, and then you have Patrick Harvey, who was a government minister, kind of failing to back the kind of process behind it, and that's very awkward for the government as well. So you have all these different things going on. Some people I spoke to suggested that what the Greens should have maybe looked to do is say, okay, our members are not happy with things like the climate targets being removed. What can you give us that we can go back to our members and say, you know, we've won this from this, and this is why we should carry on with this? Instead, it seems like they kind of almost backed Hamza into a corner here and saying, you know, we're going to have this vote. It forces the larger party to take action. They don't want to be the ones that are kicked out of the partnership. So it did feel like he was running out of ground there a little bit. Kayleigh, has this just been bad politics from the Greens? I mean, it seems like they have removed influence they had.
I think you're right. They've completely lost all the ground that they made for having such a small number of MSPs. They have really set the agenda for the last few years, and some of that has still to come up over the next few months. You've got the Heat and Buildings Bill, which has just finished consultation, the Circular Economy Bill, due to finish at the end of the month. There's lots of stuff that the Greens shaped in this Parliament, and it'll be interesting to see what happens to that going forward, whether these will be watered down through the new people coming into Cabinet. I don't think Kate Forbes is particularly keen on some of the aspects of the Heat and Buildings Bill. She had highlighted a couple of weeks ago, just before all of the chaos kicked off, about the ban on wood burners for new builds. That's another thing that is brought up in the Heat and Buildings Bill and is a big issue for rural voters. Now, obviously, I don't think she's going to go into the rural portfolio. She knocked that back when Humza offered it to her. But Cavendish have actually just done some polling in rural areas where it would be a big electoral mistake for the SNP to keep pushing on with that as it currently stands. 87% of rural voters don't feel that they've been supported to decarbonise their homes. And you can see the SNP down 9 points from 2019 in their general election voting intention for rural voters on the polling that we've done, whereas Labour are up 11 points. And that's really surprising in these rural seats where Labour probably aren't looking to make many gains outside of the Western Isles.
I mean, has it been a problem here where I spoke to Robin Harper, he is a former co-convener of the Greens, and he has some interesting things to say this weekend. He's now left the Greens, and one of the things that kind of prompted that was before the cash review came out, he wanted to bring a motion to the Green Party conference, which would have said, should we possibly delay some of the gender recognition reform bill stuff until the cash review comes out? He was, instead of that motion ever making it to conference, he was hauled in front of a conduct committee, a kangaroo court, as he described it. He had some other things to say, that he believes that the SNP and Greens together were too ambitious in terms of some of their politics, in terms of their policies, pushing forward with targets on climate that they were never going to be able to meet, all that kind of thing. Kayleigh, were the Greens, was there too much of the Greens' agenda in the government over the past 18 months here? Is that one of the problems? Because a lot of people looking on will see some of the things being pushed forward and just think, that's an SNP policy, I don't like it, I don't like the SNP, but actually these were things being driven by the Greens. Is it an issue to have a junior partner in government pushing so much of the agenda?
I think the Greens did push a lot of the agenda in recent years, and I think the SNP being distracted with their own issues going on behind the scenes has possibly led to that. What I can say is that businesses and organisations that I work with every day felt shut out of government, and a lot of things like DRS, the Greens and the SNP just were not engaging on the issue and listening to businesses who were responsible for delivering this stuff. So I think what they'll be looking for from John Swinney's government is a bit more engagement and listening to the industries that were contributing towards the targets. So if you look at the 2030 targets that were dropped, one of the sectors that was actually doing okay in those terms, albeit being held back by planning issues, was the renewable sector. The SNP were right to link the economy brief to energy, because that is going to be one of the big areas for growth. And we've talked about, if the SNP want to recover before the general election, they are going to have to get onto that economic growth message, talking about the stuff that people care about again. That's what they were really good at. And they've lost that through the sort of policies that were being pushed by the Greens over the last few years. So I would like to see them get back to a place where they are talking about the issues that people care about. It allows them to address, you know, John Swinney has said he wants to end child poverty in Scotland, and we have to have a better economy if we're going to do that. I think the other key issue there is housing. There are 10,000 kids in temporary accommodation, and the Scottish Government's failed to acknowledge that there's a housing emergency, which councils have said there is, which Shelter have said there is. And they brought forward a housing bill through the Greens that didn't provide any new homes.
We talked a little bit about Kate Forbes. I should say we are recording this podcast just before the announcement of John Swinney's new cabinet, so we don't quite know what that's going to look like yet. It is widely expected that Kate Forbes is going to be given a pretty significant role within that government. Now, some of the people I've spoken to have said that's a really important step. I think Jim Fairley, who is a Perthshire MSP, he described how there were almost kind of two different tribes within the SNP with slightly opposing opinions on what the way forward is. And previously you had them kind of warring with each other and exchanging words with the media. But if Kate Forbes comes in, suddenly you have those two tribes sitting around the cabinet table and able to have discussions and come to an agreed way forward. Justin, how important is it to have Kate Forbes back in government? And And what kind of impact is that going to have on kind of unity in the party, do you think?
I think it's pretty key for that sole point of unity. Clearly, when Kate Forbes was outside the government under Hamza Youssef, she was far from his most scathing critic. Indeed, she defended him on plenty of occasions as well. But there was just this, perhaps, a sense of unease due to how close the leadership contest was, due to the criticisms that she made of him. I think the difference will be if she's back in government. You know, some of her allies, people like, you know, Fergus Ewing, who has obviously been very critical of the party, may calm down a bit in that regard. They may still have criticisms of government policy, but I think it might be a party slightly more at ease with themselves. And I guess from John Swinney's perspective, I mean, it appears that the fact he's been willing to bring Kate Forbes on board is likely what's helped the SNP avoid the leadership contest. I guess it's better in some senses for him to have Kate Forbes on the inside rather than the outside. She is going to have to back government policy going forward, as she did under Nicola Sturgeon, you know, before Nicola Sturgeon stepped down. And I guess that means in future, I guess Kate Forbes on the outside of government has been able to sort of play this game where she's part of the SNP, but she can oppose unpopular policies at the same time. Now, I guess she's going to be linked to policies that John Swinney passes through. If it's good for John Swinney, that's great, because he's the First Minister and things work out. But if it's not as good, you know, she's still kind of closely associated with those policies and can't necessarily, you know, talk him down on the back benches. So, yeah, it seems like a pretty sensible move in that regard. It's a move that Hamza Youssef probably should have maybe made more effort to make last year. But of course, at the time, there was talk that Forbes didn't necessarily want to serve in government. There was obviously chat that, you know, she was offered the rural affairs brief as well. So I guess at the time, a lot of those wounds were perhaps quite fresh. And in some senses, Hamza thought, do I want to reward somebody who was so critical of me during the leadership campaign? But there's perhaps a bit more distance between that now, that you know, compared to back then. John Swinney and Kate Forbes perhaps might be able to work together quite well. You know, they've both held that finance brief before. John Swinney, of course, stepped in for Kate Forbes when she was offered maternity leave as well. So, yeah, it seems like quite a natural move in that respect.
So whenever I'm on hosting duties for the Stushy, I love to get people to make predictions, so I apologise in advance. I've been speaking to people quite a lot about this, actually, this week. So it's interesting to see what kind of role Kate Forbes has, because if John Swinney makes her Deputy First Minister, could that be seen as him sort of giving his seal of approval for her coming in down the line as the next SNP leader? If he doesn't go with her and goes with someone else, goes with someone new and young and ambitious, does that kind of give them the seal of approval? Does he stay with Shona Robison, who is very experienced and was in the brief already under Hamza Youssef? So Justin, what kind of role do you think Kate Forbes is going to get? And will she be Deputy First Minister?
So I predicted last week, I'm pretty sure I predicted last week was a long time ago, that she would become Deputy First Minister and Finance Secretary. I would still say I'm very confident on finance. I think you'll move Kate Forbes back to that role. I think if Kate Forbes is going to get a senior role based on what John Swinney said last week, it has to be something that she'd want the senior, and I think finance is the obvious choice. I think there's a decent chance she becomes Deputy First Minister. I'm not 100% convinced. There is a possibility, I guess, that you could stick with Shona Robison. She's been in that role. She's a senior party figure. And like you say, there's a risk that if you give it to Kate Forbes, he's almost kind of anointing her as a successor in some senses. Not necessarily. You know, there's always a leadership contest to come. But I guess that could be putting a lot of power behind one person. I guess you give somebody else the Deputy First Minister role, give Kate Forbes finance, and you're sort of spreading that power out a bit. So I would say I'm not 100%, but very convinced about finance, and 50-50 maybe on Deputy First Minister. But I would still, maybe more yes than no. But yeah, I certainly think she'll get the Finance Secretary role.
Kayleigh, what do you reckon?
Well, I agreed with Justin when he said last week that Kate Forbes would be Deputy First Minister and Finance. I think that's probably still in the cards, because I don't see what other role you could have promised to her to get her to drop her bid and come in and unify the party at this point. The question then is, where do you put Shona Robison? And I think looking ahead to after 2026 and, you know, making it clear that Kate Forbes probably isn't John Swinney's choice as the next leader, you'll want to make sure that Neil Gray, Mary McCallan, possibly Jenny Gilruth, remain in the prominent positions. But these people are already in the sort of positions that you'd want to be in if you're looking to be a leader in the future. So it may be that Cabinet doesn't change all that much. And I don't think that that will bother a lot of businesses, to be honest. I think while the last couple of weeks have been exciting, and for us political people, we enjoy the drama and the gossip of it all, businesses really just want to get on, and they want government to just get on with the job now. So they would welcome any sort of stability that comes from it. But I don't think she would have come back in and dropped the leadership bid if she hadn't been given a big job.
I agree. I think we're looking certainly at finance, I think, and the question will be Deputy First Minister, whether he stays with Shona Robinson or whether that's been part of the agreement for her not to run. There was reports of her not having, or certainly writing being on the wall, that support wasn't going to be there. So whether she's struck a deal and what she's been able to kind of get from that agreement, we don't yet know. Obviously, this podcast will be out later on, so people will know, listening to this, whether we're totally wide of the mark and something totally unexpected has happened. The other thing I wanted to ask you both about was, there were reports just over the weekend there that there's a sort of succession plot to keep Kate Forbes away from being SNP leader permanently. And plan was to keep her sort of at arm's length, and then Stephen Flynn would come in ahead of 2026 and run and try and be First Minister and SNP leader. I should say, Stephen Flynn's team spoke to the Sunday Post and absolutely rubbished that story and said there's no way whatsoever. But, you know, politics is politics. So, Justin, should we be preparing ourselves for Stephen Flynn being parachuted in before 2026 was the claim? What do you think?
I think it's tricky. I'm unsure about before 2026 now. I think it's a bad look for the SNP if they have yet another leader. I would not be shocked at all if Stephen Flynn comes to Holyrood in 2026, and if he ends up as leader after that. I think, though, that these kind of succession plots and these attempts to, you know, parachute somebody in and easily to replace somebody, it's often a bit messier than you want it to be, isn't it? Because things change, circumstances evolve. You know, there was a time a couple of years ago when Kate Forbes would have been seen as a natural successor to Nicola Sturgeon. That then changed. Not a lot of people necessarily thought Hamza Youssef would win before he ran last year, but then within days he became the favourite. So a lot could change between now and 2026. Stephen Flynn still has an election to negotiate. I would expect he holds on to his seat, but there's no guarantee. And if he doesn't, you know, does his momentum wane if he's not in Parliament for a while, for example? And sometimes it can always be a risk, can't it? If somebody is seen as a sort of anointed successor, other people perhaps get frustrated with that. There are clearly ambitious figures within the Scottish Government cabinet at the moment. You know, we've mentioned people like Jenny Gilruth and Neil Gray and Mary McCallan. Again, whether they want that job or not, it's hard to gauge. They've obviously, you know, not run for it so far, but there are clearly going to be ambitious people there. So I think the odds of Stephen Flynn being the next SNP leader after John Swinney are quite strong. I would say he's the favourite to get it, but I would not be shocked if it's a sort of bumpy road and if there's surprises along the way.
Kayleigh, what do you think?
I think he's too big of a talent for the SNP for them not to have him in a prominent role. And if they're going to lose anywhere between 15 and 25 seats at the general election, and he's leader of, you know, a handful of MPs down there, what does that give him? I think his ambition's bigger than that, his talent's bigger than that. I think he should probably go to Holyrood if that's the case. And I don't think Anna Sarwar would relish the thought of being up against him, because I think he's very talented.
It's going to be very interesting, isn't it? A very interesting time ahead. And you can keep track of it all and mark our scorecards to see how we got on later on today and down the line. But I think that's probably just about all we have time for this week. So thank you to Justin and Kayleigh, our producer Gemma, and of course to you for listening at home. And join us next time so you can be better briefed.
The Stooshy is the politics podcast from DC Thompson, designed to help you understand the implications of what happens in Holyrood, Westminster, and our communities so that you can be better briefed. Don't miss an episode by following The Stooshy today on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And if you know folks like you who want to understand politics in Scotland a little better, suggest they tune in or follow Stushy Scott on Twitter and Facebook. And stay even more up to date on local and Scottish news by subscribing to The Courier or Press and Journal, where you can get 1 month of unlimited access for just £1. Check the episode notes for details and terms.